for what you are doing and plan to do. And we praise you that there are people out there who can just talk on a telephone, somebody they've never seen, never expected to hear from, and lead them to Christ. Pray that we might be able to do that in case somebody calls us. And Lord, we turn to you now and we think in terms of being certain about who Jesus is. And we pray that you would really talk to us tonight and give us some good, hard, well thought out understanding that we can share with those who are trying to find Christ, and that which will not only undergird our own faith, but make us much more able to communicate. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, turn please to Ezekiel chapter 26. Ezekiel is not a rare disease, it's a prophet. And find him in the Old Testament. And we're going to look at seven reasons why I believe in Jesus Christ. We'll reduce them to either four or five lectures, I'm not sure. Probably four. And this is reason number one, and it is the Old Testament. Why do I believe in Jesus Christ? Number one, the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament is a remarkable book, and it is not, in the strict sense, it is not a Christian book. It was not written by Christians. It has not been preserved by Christians. And Christians have had nothing to do with its production. That is, you cannot accuse Christians for anything that's in the Old Testament. And that's good. It's an important arguing point. It's, of course, a Jewish book, and the Jews regard it as a holy book, of which God is the author. And also the Muslims regard it as a holy book, not quite as holy as the Quran, from their point of view. They also suspect the Jews of having tampered with it somewhat and changed some names over, but substantially they regard it as history, and it's true. And of course, the Christian church regards it as a sacred and inspired book. So it's the only book that is accepted by three major faiths as being a sacred book. It's remarkable for a number of reasons. One is its fulfilled prophecies. And now we're going to just look at one. There are many of them, but this is just one. And it's here in Ezekiel 26. And it has to do with the city of Tyre, T-Y-R-E, Tyre, which was the capital of Phoenicia, just to the west of the Promised Land, north and west of Israel, a long, thin country on the coast. In the 11th year, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, because Tyre has said of Jerusalem, ha ha! The gate to the nations is broken, its doors have swung open to me. Now that she lies in ruins, I will prosper. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, I am against you, O Tyre. I will bring many nations against you, like the sea casting up its waves. They will destroy the walls of Tyre, pull down her towers. I will scrape away her rubble and make her a bare rock. Out in the sea she will become a place to spread fish nets. For I have spoken, declares the Lord. She will become plunder to the nations, etc. And then he says in verse 7, for this is what the Sovereign Lord says, from the north I am going to bring against Tyre Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings. And he is going to destroy the city. And then verse 12, they will plunder your wealth, loot your merchandise, break down your walls, demolish your fine houses, and throw your stones, timber or lumber, and rubble into the sea. I will put an end to your noisy songs, and the music of your harps will be heard no more. I will make you a bare rock. You will become a place to spread fishing nets. You will never be rebuilt, for I, the Lord, have spoken. And this is a very specific prophecy. And he tells us when it was made. It was made in the 11th year. The 11th year of what? The 11th year of captivity. captivity began in 586 BC with the conquest of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. 11th year then is 575 BC. Geographically, that's the promised land. You recognize it, I trust. This is the Mediterranean Sea here. And this is Israel. This is Judah. Phoenicia is around here. And the three world powers that ebb and flow during the history of Israel, they are the egg, the ass, and the baby. And they are going around the three... What? What's the egg? Egypt. The ass? Baby? Right. Babylon has now come to power and has conquered Jerusalem, which was on the main trade route north-south. This is the ocean here. The main trade route went through Jerusalem, and Jerusalem got very wealthy out of that trade. When Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar and was destroyed, that trade switched to Tyre, which is here on the coast on this peninsula. And she was glad, the city of Tyre was delighted at the downfall of Jerusalem. God, of course, was heartbroken because it was his city. They were his people. And so this is his prophecy against Tyre, made in 575 BC. And it's very specific. One, Nebuchadnezzar is going to come. Two, he's going to come from the north. And Babylon was to the south of Phoenicia, but Neb was to come from the north. Three, Nebuchadnezzar was going to conquer. Four, he's going to put the stones, timber, and dust in the midst of the water. Five, he's going to make it like a bare rock. Six, he's going to come a place to spread fishing nets. Seven, should never be rebuilt. Now, those are very specific predictions. It was fairly probable that Nebuchadnezzar would attack because he was on the rampage. It was unlikely that he would come from the north. It was even less likely that he would conquer. And the reason for that lies in the structure of the city of Tyre. And until this point in the history, the city of Tyre had never been conquered. All the other cities, major cities, had been conquered several times. Tyre never had been. See, it was on this peninsula, and the rocks, the cliffs, were very steep. And there was nowhere that you could land a boat, anywhere around there. The city was right on the peninsula. They just had to defend one wall, that was all. And it wasn't a particularly long wall, it's quite a short one, but it enclosed a large area of land. There was grazing, there were animals, there were springs of water, there were lots of supplies to last out a long siege, and it was relatively easy just to defend one short strip of wall. And so in its whole history, Tyre had never been conquered. But now, Ezekiel says, Neb's coming, he's coming from the north, he's going to conquer, he's going to put your stones, timber, and dust in the middle of the water, you're going to become a bare rock, you're going to become a place to spread fishing nets, and you will never be rebuilt. I miss one out. And that is here. Sorry about that. We'll call it number 8 and put it in there. There'll be many nations, like waves of the sea, one after the other, coming against you. That you will find in verse 3. So, that was a prediction. And actually, having given the prediction in 575, in 573, Nebuchadnezzar attacked. In 571, Nebuchadnezzar, after a very protracted two-year bloody siege, he conquered the city of Tyre. And he completely destroyed that wall there. So that this main defense now lay in ruins. And many places this wall had been breached, and they never got a chance to build it up again, because around this area, especially the deserts to the south, there were many nomad tribes that were very fierce. And they would, without any warning, come riding in at night, bandits from the desert, and they'd just ride straight into the city and plunder the city. And if they were trying to rebuild the gaps in the walls, then they'd kill anybody around there and knock down any sort of new building. So nation after nation came, these little tribes, one after another, like waves of the sea, and that continued for more than 200 years. Beginning in 571, it continued to approximately the year 322. Just nation after nation, one after the other. But in 322, somebody new appeared on the scene, and that was your uncle Alex, known as Alexander the Great, when you're speaking more formally of him. He was king of Greece. He was a young man, Greece being, of course, way around the northern end of the Mediterranean. And he had a new hobby called world conquest. And he was setting out to conquer the world, and in fact did conquer the known world. And he came right across the northern Mediterranean, right down the eastern Mediterranean, then along North Africa through Egypt, etc. And he, of course, came to Tyre. And like all these little bandit tribes, he rode into Tyre, and there was absolutely no resistance, except for this. A few crafty merchants from the city of Tyre had actually managed to retain some wealth, build up even more wealth through the passing trade, and they had a little refuge, which was an island of a fairly curious sort of shape, about half a mile off the coast. And this island, again, is still there, totally surrounded by high cliffs. And there is nowhere all the way around the island that you can land a boat except for this bit here. And what happened was this. The few people that did have any money left, etc., converted it into portable stuff like jewelry. They stayed near the coast. If any bandits or anybody came, there was a warning given on a trumpet, and they would scramble down some steps that they had cut in the rock. And they kept a couple of little boats at the bottom, tied up to the foot of the cliffs, and they would scramble down the steps into their boats and sail across to their island, and there they would be safe. And they did that when Alexander came here. And they were so used to doing this that they felt very secure in the whole operation, because the little bandit tribes only stayed a day or two and then they cleared out. So as they began sailing across here, they looked back. This might be legend. Alexander is supposed to have sat on a white horse on the cliff tops watching them sail across. And they looked back at him, and they kind of went, you're never going to catch us, you see, which was a sort of stupid thing to do with somebody like Alexander, because he was a rather thorough sort of individual. And he was also very bad-tempered. And when they did that to Alexander, Alexander went, and steam came out of his ears, and he decided that he was going to get these guys. So he told his navy, and he had a navy, and none of the other people ever had, and Alexander actually had an extremely successful navy, and he told his navy to go and capture the island. So this mighty navy, very, very efficient navy, which was probably Alexander's most powerful weapon, in fact, sailed against the island, couldn't find anywhere to land. couldn't land anywhere right around the edge, and the only place they could go was in this narrow defile here, with these towering cliffs on either side. Well, the citizens of Tyre were on the top of the cliffs waiting for them. And all they did was pour a little oil down onto these wooden ships and then drop some burning torches into the oil, and the ships all caught fire and it was frying to night. And all the Macedonian sailors were burned up, and they were driven back and they could not get through to land on the island. And Alexander got madder still and told him to go again, and in fact sent his navy five times to capture the island, and every time the navy was driven back in utter confusion and defeat. After that, Alexander might have given up had he not been Alexander, but he didn't, and he sent his army back from Egypt all the way back to Tyre with orders to dismantle every single building in the city. And they dismantled every building, and they got the major stones, the big stones, out of the buildings, and they put them across in two columns all the way over to the island. It's only half a mile, and the water is very shallow, especially in the summertime. And they built two columns of stone all the way across. And then all the troops had to get their shields and heap up the dust. Sorry, I'm forgetting the timber. Then they had to take the big roof trusses and things out of the timber and put them across here in a lattice in between the stones. And then they had to get their shields, load all the dust onto their shields, carry it down and put it in between the timber lattices, between the stone walls, until they had a solid causeway all the way across, and then they marched across the road and took the island. What was left behind on the mainland was absolutely nothing but the bare rock foundations. When was that? 322 BC. See, so Neb came in 573, came from the north in 573, conquered in 571, many nations over the next 250 years, stones, timber, and dust in 322 BC, bare rock in 322 BC. If you were to take your vacation there this coming summer, which if you can afford it, you can go there. And what you will see is, you will see the bare rock that was once the city of Tyre. If you go there in the morning, you'll see this. The stones are still there. The timbers and the dust has all washed out long since, but the big stones are still there. And you will see the fishermen from the island, after a night's fishing, hang up their nets on those stone walls to dry. When is that? 1988 AD. You check back on the mainland, it has never been rebuilt. That is very unusual because it's a first-class site for a city. And all the old cities were destroyed, but because they were in a good position, they were rebuilt. There's at least nine Jerusalems, one on top of each other, one on top of the ruins of the previous one, etc. Tyre is a brilliant site for a city. It has got an excellent water supply, adequate to serve a major city anywhere in the world today. And the springs of fresh water bubble up out of the ground and they just cascade down into the ocean. Nobody uses it. It's a well-defended place. It's on a trade route. It's fertile. It's got everything a city needs, but it's never been rebuilt. And everything that God said about the city in 575 BC has progressively come true over all these centuries, right down to the present day, when you can go and look at the evidence. If you can't go and look at the evidence, you just want to read about it, you will find it. If you want to check it out in any major library, you'll find an Encyclopedia Britannica. See, and that is kind of standard reference work in any major library. You'll find it's all in there. See? If you can afford it, go see it. It's very convincing. There's a scientist by the name of Peter W. Stoner writing for Moody Press a book called Science Speaks. Stoner is a man with a first-class PhD in statistics. That is his particular specialty. Degree, if I remember rightly, from Minneapolis, but I'm not very sure. But a perfectly good, legitimate PhD in statistics estimates the possibility of Ezekiel predicting that just out of his own intelligence and the material available to him at the time, if he'd got all the knowledge available at the time, statistically, the odds are 37 million to one against. Kind of a long shot if you want to back those kind of statistics. Interesting book. You probably won't agree with all of it, but it's worth reading. Shouldn't agree with all of it, but it's still worth reading. And that's just one of several predictions which are historically verifiable and which he works through. And it's by no means the most extreme. It's just the easiest one to cover in the time. That's why we've done it. Now turn, please, to Leviticus chapter 15. And Leviticus has to do with, this part has to do with skin diseases. Please turn quickly because we're galloping. You need to see Leviticus, written by Moses, year approximately 1500 BC. 1500 BC. You need to see it in terms of the background of the day. The most advanced culture of this time was Egypt, by a long, long way. We mentioned them this morning, pyramids, etc. This has to do with what you did if you had an infectious skin disease, including leprosy, but not restricted to leprosy. The word requires a broader understanding than merely leprosy as we know it today. An infectious skin disease. If you had driven a little piece of wood into your skin in Egypt in the same time, and now in England we'd call it a splinter, but I've heard it called other things other places, so I'm not sure. But if you do that, what do? We just pull it out and put some disinfectant on, right? But what they would do in Egypt is this. They would make for you a nice little poultice of worm's blood and donkey dung, well mixed up. And they wouldn't pull the thing out. They would just put it on the place, and it would be wrapped up there and kept there by some leaves. See? What did that do? Well, of course, it allowed sepsis from the donkey dung to get into your bloodstream that killed you. And it may seem to us slightly primitive from our standpoint, but remember, Egypt was the most advanced culture of the day, and we've got to see Moses set against his times. Now, Leviticus 15. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, speak to the Israelites, say to them, when any man has a bodily discharge, the discharge is unclean, whether it continues flowing from his body or is crystallized or blocked, it will make him unclean. This is how his discharge will bring about his uncleanness. Any bed he lies on, unclean. Anything he sits on, unclean. Anyone who touches his bed must wash his clothes, bathe with water, be unclean till evening. Whoever sits on anything the man with a discharge sat on must wash his clothes, bathe with water, be unclean till evening. Whoever touches the man who has a discharge must wash his clothes, bathe with water, be unclean till evening. If the man with a discharge spits on someone who is clean, that man must wash his clothes, bathe with water, be unclean till evening. Everything the man sits on when riding will be unclean. Whoever touches any things that were under him will be unclean till evening. Whoever picks up those things must wash his clothes, bathe with water, be unclean till evening. A clay pot the man touches, verse 12, must be broken. Any wooden article is to be washed with water. When a man is cleansed from his discharge, he is to count off 7 days for his ceremonial cleansing. Wash his clothes, bathe with running water, and be clean. Sounds fairly obvious to us. What is it? It's simple hygiene. That's what it is. Okay? And it's very effective. Like this, the man himself is unclean. What does unclean mean? It means he can't associate with anybody, he can't go to work, and he can't go to worship. He's cut off from the temple, cut off from his work, cut off from contact. If anybody does have contact with him, that person is unclean. Not in an ongoing sense like he is, but this is what he's got to do. He remains unclean till the evening. That means he's already finished work for the day. He's got no responsibilities. All he's got to do is wash himself, and wash his clothing. No excuses. He don't have anything else to do. Right? Work's done. Can't go to worship. All he's got to do is get washed. Simple, clear cut, very effective. He didn't tell them why. He just told them to do it. But he did give them a promise. Here's a reference, Deuteronomy 7:15. If you obey my laws, you will not suffer from any of the diseases you knew in Egypt. Clear cut promise. If you obey my laws, you will not suffer from any of the diseases you knew in Egypt. And this was one of them. There were others that had to do with things like going to the bathroom. They had to, this is when they lived in the desert, they had to go and dig a little hole. Go out of the camp, dig a little hole, do what they had to do and fill it in again. Slightly primitive, but effective. You know, if they had done that in any of the major cities of the advanced cultures, 3,000 years later, all sorts of horrible diseases would never have happened. The Great Plague of London would never have happened. The Black Death in Calcutta would never have happened. Diseases like cholera, typhoid, etc. would not be existent in the world if people followed the simple instructions given back then by God through Moses. Too smart to do that. Even in advanced Europe in the 16th, 17th, even 18th century. Too intelligent to follow the instructions of God. And so these sort of diseases were spread because of lack of sanitation. Now here, a very simple thing. You just wash. Clay jar's got to be broken. Why? Clay is porous, it's not glazed, you can't be sure you can wash it properly. Break it, don't use it again. Wooden vessel, you can wash that, wash it, and then you can use it again. Real. He didn't explain why. He didn't say there were germs that are far too small for you to see with a naked eye, and they'll be there, and they'll transmit the disease to you. He didn't say that, and they didn't know it, and they probably wouldn't have understood it. And why should he say it anyway? They were his people, they should obey him. He says, if you obey me, you won't suffer from these diseases. Now let's come a little more up to date. How far up to date? From Moses, remember, is 1500 BC. How far up? 1847 AD. Most advanced hospital in the world, Vienna, Austria. That time, young doctor named Semmelweis. Doctor in a ward, which ward? The gynae ward. Can't spell that. Gynecology. So, there he is. He's concerned about the death rate. So he should be. It's over 60% in his particular ward. And he's concerned about this very high death rate. And he begins to keep very careful statistics. And he finds that nearly all the patients who die have been examined by the professor of surgery or one of his students. So, he thinks about that, and he continues to keep records. He's very concerned. And so, he asks the professor of surgery, if he would mind, if he and his students would wash their hands before coming into the ward. This was a practice world's most advanced hospital 140 years ago. The professor came in along with his students and went to the mortuary. What do you find in the mortuary? The bodies of those who died yesterday or during the night. What did they do when they got there? They chopped up the bodies for the professor to give lectures to the students and also to examine them and see whether they could find out the cause of death as they chopped up the bodies. What happens when you chop up a dead body? With no gloves on. Yeah, if in the very unlikely event that there are any germs in that dead body, you pick them up. Right? You realize there probably could be germs. And they picked all those up, and then they went straight into the ward and examined the living patients. So what happened? Kind of obvious to us, isn't it? So Semmelweis says to the professor of surgery, would you mind, when you come into my ward, you and your students wash your hands? The professor was furious. An important man, busy day, one of the most educated people in the city, a man whose life is dedicated to saving lives and to bringing healing. Not a fool, bright, very bright. Really, I'm a busy man. I've not got time to go through all this junk. And some of us said, just for an experiment, just do it for a month. And so they did it for a month, and the year, or the month, was May 1847. In April 1847, there were 57 deaths in that ward. In May 1847, there was one death. That sound like a significant statistic to you? Semmelweis thought it was quite significant. But he continued to keep very careful records, not only of those who died, but also of those who had fever, high temperature, etc. And again he noticed a pattern of the spread of fevers. And the pattern had nothing to do with age, nothing to do with where they'd come from, nothing to do with proximity in the ward. The pattern was the visiting medical staff and especially the professor and his team. So now he says to the professor, bear with me a little longer. Would you mind if you ever touch a patient who's got a high temperature, would you wash your hands before you touch another one? Result, Semmelweis is thrown out of the hospital. Cannot get another job in medicine anywhere in the country of Austria. Goes back to his home country, which was Hungary. Got a job there in a hospital in Budapest. For 6 months he worked there, bringing in the same practice. After 6 months, he was thrown out of medicine in Hungary. He never got a job anywhere in medicine in the rest of his life. Died in an insane asylum in the year 1874. Why? Because he knew without any doubt that in every major hospital disease and death was being transmitted by those who thought they were bringing healing. And that he had the answer, but nobody would listen to him. Moses said, if you had contact even with the clothing of somebody with one of these infectious diseases, you go wash yourself. The first place anywhere in the world to introduce a law that a doctor must wash his hands before examining a patient, the year was 1920, and the place was Great Britain. In 1920, Great Britain started catching up with Moses. However, picture this. An old-fashioned wash basin. Doctor has just conducted an operation or something. Comes in, turns on the taps. Puts a plug in the plug hole. Turns off the taps, washes his hands on a bar of soap. Puts the soap back. Pulls out the plug and leaves the taps infected, the soap infected, and the basin infected. right? So what they do? Well, a few years ago, they introduced taps with long arms, and you pushed them on with your elbows and washed your hands. And everything went straight down the drain, and you didn't touch anything till it was all gone. Later than that, a foot pedal, so that you couldn't even touch the arms by accident. Now, an electronic beam. The first place to introduce a law that a doctor had to wash his hands under running water, the year was 1964. That's within my lifetime, some of yours too. Where was that? It was the Golden State. In 1964, California caught up with Moses. The Old Testament is an amazing book. Turn to Luke 24, quickly. Quickly, quickly. Time's giving up on us here. The Old Testament is an amazing book. Why? Because it contains prophecies which have come specifically and verifiably true over centuries. It's an Old Testament book. Why? Because it's advanced health understanding that no man could have known, but God gave to his people out of his love and as a safeguard for them. And his laws are not given to be a frustration. They're given to be a protection and an enrichment. Luke 24:13. Same day, two of the disciples, were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles north of Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked among them. They didn't recognize him. He asked, "What are you discussing together?" They were sad. One of them said, "You're the only one living in Jerusalem who doesn't know." "What about?" he says. "About Jesus," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed, and before God and all the people," etc. Then they said that they had hoped that he would have been the one to redeem Israel. Verse 25, he said to them, "How foolish you are, how slow of heart in getting round to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Didn't the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses," what's Moses? Genesis through Deuteronomy. "Beginning with Moses and all the prophets," what's that? All the rest of the Old Testament. The five books of Moses and all the rest of the Old Testament. "He expounded to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." That word expound means this. You take the scriptures as they stand, and you bring out of them the meaning that they contain but is hidden, and you make it evident. You don't distort the scriptures. You don't force upon them some meaning that they don't have, but you bring out of them the meaning that they contain. Like this one, Isaiah. "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." Not hard to take a meaning out of that, is it? They didn't understand it in Isaiah's day, but when Jesus came and fulfilled it, the meaning was there all the time. It just needed to be brought out and shown to them. So what did Jesus do? He took two of his disciples who were necessarily Jews, right? As Jews, they knew the Old Testament, right? He took two men who knew the Old Testament and knew himself. Knew the book, and they knew the facts of Jesus' life and ministry. What they'd never seen was the two put together. What was the result of this? You see, he expounded to them things concerning himself. Why? Because the Old Testament is a book about Jesus. The result? Verse 32, they asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" our hearts burned. We got all excited when he opened those scriptures we'd known all our lives but never understood. Now, turn with me to Acts 17 quickly. We've got about, I don't know how long left. I haven't been warned there's less than 5 minutes yet. 5 minutes, right, thank you. Acts 17. Verse 1, verse 2. As his custom was, note that, this is standard technique, this is what he always did. Paul went into the synagogue. What do you find in the synagogue? Jews. And on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah, he said. That was Paul's standard technique. He didn't go around making emotional appeals. You need this or God will blast you. He didn't say that. He didn't go around saying, I've got a free gift to offer you. Come and pray the prayer and I'll give it to you. He explained and reasoned and proved from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. To whom did he do that? To people who already had the scriptures and knew them. Move on with me in Acts 17. You had to leave there. Verse 11. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. Therefore, many of the Jews believed. They were open-minded, they weren't stupid, they weren't gullible, but they were open-minded. They were prepared to dig out the scriptures and check and research. Does it really? Hey, it does. And many of them believed because they were prepared to investigate and to research it. Okay? Chapter 18, verse 24. A Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord and spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He'd never heard the gospel, never heard Jesus, never met a disciple, yet he talked about Jesus accurately. Why? Because Jesus is the theme of the Old Testament. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. When Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. On arriving, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed because, verse 28, he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. See? The Old Testament is an amazing book, fulfilled prophecies, advanced health insights, tremendous book, but it is a book from beginning to end about Jesus Christ. It is begun, probably the earliest book is Job, but the earliest after that would be the books of Moses, 1500. It's finished 400 years before Jesus Christ was born, the Old Testament was finished. But it's a book about Jesus from beginning to end. And he is the main theme of every book in the Old Testament. If we could find a book like that today, it would have begun in the year 500 and finished when Columbus discovered America. But a book about you, with your name, where you'd be born, what you would do, what kind of a person you would be, how and where you would die, and one or two other little interesting details like that. It'd be kind of interesting if we could find a book like that about you, wouldn't it? All finished before America was discovered, but accurately telling your life story in many details. That's what the Old Testament is to Jesus Christ. That's one of the reasons why I'm convinced about him. The Old Testament's not a Christian book, not written by Christians, not preserved by Christians. It's Jewish.
They kept it. They wrote it. They kept it. They preserved it. They passed it on from generation to generation. But everything you want to know about Jesus was prophesied hundreds of years before he appeared on the scene. That's one of the things that really convinces me that Jesus is the Son of God. Father, we thank you that we don't have to commit intellectual suicide in order to believe. Thank you that the most logical thing in the world is to recognize that the only adequate explanation for Jesus is yourself. That he really is the Son that you said will be coming, the Messiah, the King, of whose kingdom there would be no end. But the increase of his government and peace, there would be no end. We would acknowledge him happily as our King tonight. Not simply convinced about who he is, but allowing him and desiring him to be who he is in our own experience. For his name's sake.